Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I am super excited to have with me on Zoom, Adam Bezvanic. Adam is founder and managing partner of Looking Glass Capital, a pre-seed and seed stage focused venture fund. Adam, great to have you with me here today. How cold is it out there with you, where you are?
Arish, it's great to be here. It's great to be inside. It's going down to about 7 Fahrenheit tonight and I think 2 Fahrenheit tomorrow morning. So I'm going to get a lot of email done.
Yeah, you're wrapped up and ready to go. I have to be honest, over here in the UK, we've suddenly managed to get out of the cold snap we're in. Anyway, enough about the weather. That's a very British thing to talk about. Let's talk about some more interesting stuff. So one of the first things I want to talk to you about is your time at Lowercase Capital. So for our listeners who may not know enough about you, please do head over and check out our primer where Adam goes through some of his background, what he's been doing, and all about Looking Glass and the sort of businesses that they're investing in. But Adam, back in the day, you worked with Lowercase, which is Chris Sacker's fund. You were involved in all sorts of things from projects with Twitter and Uber and beyond. I'd really love to understand from you, was tech and investing something that you inherently knew you wanted to do? Because your background has really followed that path, really from day one. So I'd love to understand, was that something that you knew right from an early age that you wanted to get into? Or did you fall into it?
I would say I knew I wanted to be around founders from a relatively early age. My dad is an entrepreneur. He is the founder of a company. It's not a tech company, but I saw him raise a little bit of outside capital for it from angel investors. I saw him grow it, the ups and downs that came with different periods and sort of the sector that he was operating in. And something about working with founders is truly, and it sounds corny, but I think it's truly like inspirational to see someone go from 0 to 1, which is part of the most exciting part about investing at the stage that I do. And so I knew I wanted to be in and around entrepreneurship in some way, form, or fashion. I didn't know whether that was going to be as a founder myself or whether that was going to be as an investor and supporter or advisor to entrepreneurs. But I knew I wanted to be around people starting things. I had a finance job after school, sort of a stereotypical investment banking analyst gig. I knew that I didn't love mature companies. I knew I didn't love like working in Excel nonstop, not just the hours, but sort of, the tedium of evaluating late stage and mature businesses, which is not something that really got me that excited. And so I think naturally sort of this desire to be in around founders and liking evaluating companies, but not sort of the minutiae of just living inside an Excel spreadsheet sort of naturally pushed me towards early stage venture. And I think, like a lot of people who think they want to do VC, they probably only know about like 6% of what VC actually entails. And now having been in venture for full time for almost a decade, I am self-aware enough to admit I really didn't know all that much about what I was doing or what I thought I would be doing. But I was also self-aware enough to, I think, approach the process of trying to break into venture in a very like earnest way. I cold emailed literally hundreds of VCs. I was active on Twitter. I was trying to write blog posts. I was trying to sort of do everything I possibly could to put myself out there. And Chris is just one of the investors that I happened to email and tweet with. He's one of the people that happened to respond to my email. And then he was, patient enough with me to cave and give me some work to do when I was getting my MBA, and really allowed me to learn a lot, really through osmosis. Just seeing how he worked with founders, seeing how he worked with portfolio companies. And I sort of got the bug from, doesn't hurt that I was around the most successful pre-seed or seed venture fund of all time to catch that bug. But learned obviously a lot from him, and it certainly shaped the way that I think about interacting with founders and building this firm.
Amazing. I think that really resonates because, you said something that you didn't know, that much about venture when you got into it. I think a lot of people could argue that a lot of VCs didn't know much about venture over the last decade because some of the stuff that we've been investing in has definitely not been the right kind of deal. But actually, all joking aside, I think obviously learning from someone like Chris Sacher is absolutely amazing, but equally you went into projects with companies like Twitter and Uber, like in, relatively early on in their life cycle. So just give us a bit of an understanding of what that was like. And did that bring you closer to that kind of founder entrepreneurial, activity that you were looking for? Because, you know, those are obviously incredible businesses that are household names today. And I just love to get that kind of insight as an intern MBA being dropped into these like massive tech companies or like super scaling tech companies, how that was and how that impacted you.
Yeah, I mean, the project with Twitter was the first thing I ever did with Chris. And he basically told me, I'm not going to interview you. I'm not going to like reference check you. I've read your tweets. I've read your blog posts. I've seen how you've interacted with me. And I think you could be helpful to this project that Twitter has. Which was, they were evaluating a buy versus build scenario in terms of like an M&A transaction. And this is fall of 2011. So Twitter was not quite Twitter yet, but it was getting there. And I worked really closely with Adam Bain, who had been recently hired at Twitter. I think he was there for less than a year at this point to run sales. So they were just trying to figure out how to monetize. And the project was deciding whether they should buy a company called Sumify, which ended up buying, which became their email digest product essentially. And they folded this product in, which would summarize, you know, all of the tweets you missed based on people you follow or categories you're interested in, whether they were sports or news. And I built a model to look at how could Twitter monetize email, right? Could they put in promoted tweets or ads or promoted follows into email digests that they would send users as a way of engaging with them, or re-engaging lapsed users to come back to Twitter and go back to the feed. And I think one of the most important parts of that project was actually like the relationships that I built at Twitter because of working with Chris. So like I literally had a call with Adam Bain 2 days ago to send him a company that I invested in at DeepFork that's raising a Series C right now, because it could be a fit for his firm now. So this is a relationship that was, you know, a decade, you know, a dozen years in the making. And so I think to me, like what was most important about working with Chris in some ways, obviously, was being around these great companies and seeing, what worked for them and how I could draw on that to potentially help founders that I would eventually work with or invest in. But almost more importantly was the relationships and the access that working with Chris gave me, because those are now relationships that I've been able to, you know, nurture and foster and carry on, you know, and now they're my own relationships, having been sort of in the space now for a decade.
It's always something that, you know, I think about quite deeply. The VC ecosystem is just that. It's an ecosystem, right? It's built on relationships. It's built on those sort of relationships that would have been forged either by founders and their employees and their teams who then go out and, you know, build their own businesses or raise funds or go and work for VCs, et cetera, right? And I think one of the important things is whilst those relationships are hugely important for the ecosystem, we've got to be really conscious about making sure that they're also accessible, right? Because lots of people don't have the privilege or the ability, I guess, to break into those relationships in the same way that you have, or maybe I would have had. It'd be interesting, how would you kind of suggest to people that they might sort of approach that? Like if they're trying to find their way into those relationships, you know, either as a founder or as someone that wants to work in VC, like how would you recommend they do that if they don't have, you know, the ability to work with a firm like Lowercase?
Sure. I mean, I think candidly, like I didn't have the ability to work with a firm like Lowercase, sort of on the surface. Like Chris wasn't hiring an intern. Like I just cold emailed him and literally probably 200 other venture investors over the course of a, you know, several month to year period. And through sheer force of will, like got coffee with a lot of them. Did Skype calls back when Skype was a thing with some of them, phone calls with them. I mean, Chris, I actually just sent him a list of questions over email and he responded asynchronously over email to start, because that's what his like schedule allowed at the time. And so many of those people are now investors in Looking Glass Fund 1 and Fund 2. Some of these people I've co-invested with, some of these people that ignored my email have now become friends. They didn't realize that I was emailing them. They just, you know, a lot of people don't read every email that they get because they're inundated. And so I think I was also fortunate enough that 2011, like venture wasn't like a cool thing to do yet. The move from finance to venture was not an obvious one at all, or finance to tech was not an obvious one in 2011. Probably wasn't until like 2013, 2014 that it became sort of the, like a very natural path for someone to go from like 2 years as an analyst to going working at like Facebook or Google. And so I tell people all the time that are, you know, 10 plus years younger than me, that I also got really lucky that I was investing at, or I was trying to break into this space at a time where like there was a lot less noise and known VCs were super active on Twitter and they were much more accessible. Now I think the path that I went could certainly work, but it's kind of lazy. Like what I've seen a lot of people do is they've built, you know, I mean, they're technical, they've built products, they've launched stuff on Product Hunt as like side hustles, and it's gotten people's attention. You have people that launch Substacks and they're incredible analysts of companies and products. And, you know, it's similar to the blog that I was running on Tumblr back in the day.
Folk like Packy, who I think you co-invest with, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've known Packy since I was 14 years old, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. We went to rival high schools and we went to college together. And so, yeah, Packy, I mean, Packy sort of went the route of banking, startup, and then he just started writing. And obviously he's built an incredible following, and he has multiple funds, and he has a gig at, you know, Andreessen as a, you know, advisor on their crypto side. And it's literally just from writing and building a following essentially from scratch. And so, you know, tools like Twitter and Substack and Medium have enabled even people who have built up incredible things on TikTok have done, have really opened up the ability for people to put their thoughts out there and be known and heard. I mean, Turner Novak, who runs Banana Capital, another solo GP, like Turner, I think he worked at like a pension or an endowment as an LP, but he wanted to break into venture, and he would write up these sort of like hypothetical like startup portfolios. Like these are the companies that I would invest in if I had a fund, and he would track that portfolio progress over time as those companies raised rounds of capital, and ended up working out of four ventures with my friend Gaurav for a little bit. And then he ended up starting his own fund. And like, that was someone, and you know, Turner lives in Michigan. He's not living in a hotbed of venture activity. And so I think there's opportunity now for platforms that have made people's voices heard a lot more easily. And I think the ability to get attention is a lot, in some ways, it's a lot easier because the known entities, a lot of the known VCs have become a lot more quiet. They're not as active on Twitter. They're not publishing as much on Substack. And so it's actually opened up this, this space for a lot of emerging voices and emerging thought, leadership to come to the fore in a way that I think wasn't actually like that available, 8 to 10 years ago.
Yeah. And that's, be it podcasts, be it Twitter spaces, be it syndicates, obviously that are really now easy to kind of spin up and get going. We've had like the founders of Vauban, which was acquired by Carta. We've had the founder of Odin here in the UK, which again is another sort of SPV formation venture. And, we're seeing more and more of that, certainly here in the UK, where solo kind of GPs are starting out really just by raising these syndicates. And, over time, if they then decide they want to launch a fund, they launch a fund. But actually, to some extent, a lot of them like the ability to just kind of launch an SPV and do it on a rolling basis rather than having to go out and actually raise a fully fledged fund. So, yeah, I completely agree. I mean, obviously, we've had here in the UK examples like Harry Stebbings, who off the back of his podcast was able to raise an amazing fund. And others like, we mentioned Packy McCormick, Paige Finn Doherty, who's also been on the pod. Like there's been a lot of people that I think have leveraged that social presence. From backgrounds or ages where it wouldn't have necessarily been the most obvious thing to do to raise a fund and been able to go out and progress towards that. So I think that's super useful. And it's interesting that you said it wasn't a cool thing to do back then. I was reading, in fact, you're talking about Twitter earlier. I was reading something that you said just yesterday, I think, right? And you said the best part of the current venture funding market is that it has provided a tremendous amount of clarity. So I think for our UK listeners, it'd be really cool to understand what is the current state of play in the venture kind of ecosystem, certainly in the US, and how you might see that kind of globally, if at all. And, you know, what is that clarity that has been brought, and what are the implications of that?
Sure. So I think just quickly on where I think the current market sits, I think the pre-seed and seed market is still, you know, as robust and as crowded as ever. I think you've also started to see some later stage firms downshift to write more seed checks because they can get close to the same amount of ownership as a Series A investment with putting a lot less capital at risk. And so you've started to see some inflated seed rounds. I saw one person, another solo GP yesterday, tweet that she hadn't seen a seed round under $7 million in the last, you know, several weeks, which, you know, that seems like a lot of money for a seed, but perhaps these rounds are just getting inflated because you have, you know, an influx of later stage capital coming in to jam, yep, sort of jam things in. But that market has not, in my opinion, hasn't really gotten much more quiet compared to some of the other later stages over the last, you know, 6, 8, 10 months. What I have found at that stage, though, is, at least for me, I'm seeing a much higher signal to noise ratio. And by that, I mean the quality of companies related to the quantity is much better. I just think the bar for starting a company right now is exceptionally high. And if you were a fly-by-night founder, or you were going to, you know, see if you could raise a little bit of money and then quit your job based on VCs funding your idea or your side hustle, that just doesn't really happen right now the way it did in 2021. And so I'm seeing a lot more ideas and products pressure tested by founders before they actually go out to raise capital, which is, you know, which is refreshing to me, and, you know, ultimately beneficial for investors to have something that feels even just a touch de-risked compared to something that's, you know, literally just an idea. Though certainly I still will fund those two for the right team and the right market. I think Series A rounds are getting done, but you need to be an exceptionally strong company and exceptionally strong team to get those rounds done at valuations that you and your existing investors are happy with. And then Series B and Series C rounds, I think, are probably the most tricky right now.
Yeah.
Sort of that growth stage deal where, you know, you probably raised an overinflated Series A or Series B in 21, or, you know, maybe early 22. Now you're in market and no one is willing to pay the price that you raised the last round at, let alone an up round, because the last two rounds were probably overvalued significantly. And then the later stage stuff, you know, those companies might be taking down rounds, but like there's still going to be a, you know, quote unquote flight to quality,
yeah,
to winners or perceived winners. Very similar to what we saw at the beginning of COVID, where, you know, pre-seed and seed still remained relatively active because people were comfortable deploying small checks over Zoom, and it felt, you know, a lot less risky. And then Series A through C was basically like a no man's land.
It was carnage.
And then Series D and later just got, you know, flooded with capital, right? Because people were like, well, I can, it's less about a person bet at this stage. I probably have been tracking this company for a while already. I probably already have a relationship with the entrepreneur. And let me just look at the latest numbers, and I'm just running stuff in Excel and getting comfort with that. And so I don't necessarily need to see this person face to face. I think that dynamic has emerged for different reasons now. But I think that's a similar sort of barbell dynamic that we're seeing in the market, similar to sort of March, April, May of 2020.
And I think that's really interesting. And you're the first person I've heard talk about it in terms of what we saw in 2020, but actually that's exactly what we saw in 2020, as you correctly point out. Like, it was, you know, I think there were ideas that weren't getting funded. There were decent pre-seed businesses which had legs, which, you know, were lower risk and therefore could get funded. But it was that mid-range of seed Series A where, like, you know, product market fit was maybe there, maybe just about there, but hard to take that hard bet and deploy a large amount of capital. Obviously, post that you've got, you know, much more metric, you know, many more metrics or traction to hang your hat on. So I think that made life a lot easier. So yeah, that's a very, very interesting sort of juxtaposition. I'd also be interested to understand from your perspective, do you think we've reverted to where we were back in 2011, 2012, 13, when you were with Lowercase, as compared to the last 10 years? Like, is that the right sort of analysis, or is this a new era altogether and we just got to treat it, you know, as a completely different different time?
I think from a valuation perspective, I think we're retreating closer to 2014 through 2016, mm-hmm. which is when I was at Deep Fork. Fred Wilson put out a post shortly after the start of the year where he said surviving in 2023 is thriving. And he called out new sort of valuation ranges for pre-seed, seed, A, and B, I think.
Yeah.
And I think Fred called out like 2015 as sort of the analog to when these types of deals would get done. I still see things that are out of, you know, slightly above that in terms of price at the pre-seed and seed stage, but I largely think we've reverted back to sometime around there where, you know, raising $1 million pre-seed round is getting done at, you know, 4 to 6 post, right? You're giving up somewhere between 16 and 25% of the company for $1 million. A $3 million seed round is probably at somewhere between, you know, 10 to 15 post. Mm. You know, 4 million, you know, fortunately I've had a lot of companies from Fund One. I've had 7 companies from Fund One raise priced equity rounds in the last 4 months. One was a company called Hone, which I mentioned in the primer, which is doing very, very well and is well beyond that from a seed range. But the other 6 were all raising between $3 and $5 million. And they're all largely giving up somewhere between 18 and 25% dilution. Wow.
Yeah.
So they're all raising somewhere between, you know, 15 to 20 million post money valuations for $3 to $5 million rounds. And some of these businesses are only a couple months old, but there's tons of momentum around them. Some of these businesses are 15 months old and they've just hit a, you know, an inflection point. But largely I think that's a valuation range and a dilution range that we saw, you know, certainly pre-COVID and probably closer to the 2016, 2017 range, from a timing perspective.
Yeah.
I think that everyone's saying this is the new normal. This is normal.
Yeah.
Right. 2021, you know, the back part of 20 through, you know, basically November, December, through all of 21, essentially, that was not normal.
That was just people, I think, coming out of lockdown and just too much exuberance, too much sort of, you know, just, hey, we've just got to get out there and start deploying again. I think there was just this, like this almost celebratory kind of atmosphere that was going around and the party rounds were being done and lots of FOMO, all this sort of stuff. Exactly as you said, I think 2020, back end of 2020, 2021 were like completely outliers, you know, in the last sort of 5-10 years.
Right. I think it's, you know, whether it's a combination of, you know, zero interest rate phenomenon or too much, which is also a function of too much LP capital in the market and GPs needing to deploy it or thinking they need to deploy it quickly so they can go back and raise, you know, subsequent larger funds. I think the public markets sort of anointing, you know, Uber and Airbnb and DoorDash and Coinbase and others as $100 billion companies, you know, certainly gave people the idea that, all right, well, $100 billion is the new sort of unicorn. $1 billion is not a unicorn anymore. When in reality, probably like somewhere between $5 and $10 billion is the new unicorn. But when you're underwriting something to 10 to 20X higher than that, you think you can afford to pay 10 to 20X higher at entry. And so entry prices just skyrocketed because people correlated those to much higher exit possibilities.
Yeah. Absolutely crazy. Well, look, I mean, I'm very much glad that we're kind of out of the euphoria. I think, you know, getting back to fundamentals is never a bad thing. So let's actually talk a little bit about Looking Glass now. I just want to touch on a couple of things. So, you know, we just talked about the challenges for or the new or the normal, new normal, if you like, within venture financing. How's that been from an LP perspective? So you're raising fund two, you raised fund one in 2019-20, as you mentioned, right through COVID. What have been the challenges raising today versus 2-3 years ago?
And the biggest challenge 2 or 3 years ago was, you know, you're a fund one, you don't, you know, as much as I felt like I, you know, had built a very credible track record as a as an investor and partner at other firms, ultimately you're still under someone else's shingle, regardless of whether that firm is known or not. There's always the benefit of having, you know, resources, partners, capital, et cetera, that, you know, that is not your own. And so ultimately, I think a lot of people are wary of any first time, you know, fund manager going out solo. And so that was certainly something I had to combat. My first conversations around fund one were in January of 2020. COVID and lockdown happened, you know, mid-March. I joke that I started fundraising in January. I stopped fundraising in March and I started fundraising again in June. And so like that ultimately was just, it was really hard. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no getting around it, but I think, and people weren't really willing to write checks over Zoom into new managers and blind pools. Like there's just a lot working against you. I think the challenges now are very different. Like fund one, like I mentioned, is like really inflecting and doing quite well from a markups perspective. I think the challenge now is, you know, are LPs sitting on their hands because they're a little bit wary of the market? Did they deploy way too aggressively in 2022? Are they budgeting for investors coming back that they already have relationships in 23, and so they have to, you know, set aside capital for existing manager relationships that they have? So, you know, that's always going to be a struggle. But I think the overhang of potential recession or, you know, markdowns or, you know, later stage capital being completely sort of like, you know, just that powder is totally wet. Like I think there's just sort of a lot of variables that are keeping people sort of at bay. I think the way that I've described it though is like kind of the longer it takes me to raise fund two, the easier it gets to raise fund two. So, you know, like I said, I've had a bunch of markups in the last 4 months. 4 months ago, a lot of people told me they wanted to see more progress. Well, now there's a lot more, there's more progress, and now there's actually a lot more interest around fund two. So I really describe it as like, I'm running up this like very steep hill, and at a certain point I'm going to get to the top of this hill and I'm going to be running downhill with this fundraise. And I think I'm approaching that like precipice right now, as fund one matures. And then it also doesn't hurt that, you know, there's companies in fund two now. So people have an idea of like what they're investing in. It's not a blind pool. The first investment from fund one already, or from fund two already has been marked up. So people feel like there's like a little bit of a bonus there when they come into fund two. So these types of things will help the raise go a lot more smoothly, but certainly the broader economic climate right now, I think is certainly the most challenging piece.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the only thing I'd kind of add to that is I think, you know, now we're in sort of February of 2023 already. I think there was a massive pullback at the back end of last year. I think there was a lot of fear in the market. There was a lot of uncertainty. There was a lot of, you know, I think LPs were definitely sitting on their hands then because, you know, they just simply couldn't see, you know, a path forward. I think things have started becoming clearer, both in terms of, you know, how deep, if at all, a recession is going to be in the US, and it feels like it's not going to be anywhere near as bad as was anticipated. It looks like rate hikes won't be as high as anticipated, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that kind of slight, you know, that additional certainty, if I can put it that way, is starting to loosen the purse strings, if I'm reading the situation correctly. I don't think it's going to be, you know, I don't think it's going to be open season. And I think there's definitely, you know, there's still challenges there, but it definitely feels like people are starting to kind of get back out there from an LP perspective. And I think the other massive benefit, and you alluded to this, obviously, because, you know, you raised during COVID, is in person is back. Like, you know, these large LPGP events are happening, you know, family office events are happening. And that just means the ability for fund managers like yourself and others to get out there and actually kind of, you know, speak to people, meet people that you wouldn't have otherwise met, like has improved massively.
Exactly. And I tweeted about this a few weeks ago. And I said, sort of the long and short was like, you need to go out and meet people in person to fundraise now. And it was, it's funny, I had a couple founders in my portfolio see that tweet and they thought I was subtweeting them. And so they got on planes for their raises right now. Amazing. And a couple of them were successful in running those processes. But really, I told one, it was more sort of meant to be a kick in the ass to myself to go out there. So I've trips to Toronto, Chapel Hill, South Florida, and Austin all in the next 4 weeks for LP meetings. And those are, it's entirely because, to your point, like, things are open now. You need to be meeting in person. These are decade, hopefully multi-decade, you know, relationships that need to be forged by spending time with people, you know, having lunch, having a meal with them. And it's, you know, it's a requirement.
Yeah, no, for sure. And look, I love the fact that you subtweeted yourself and managed to galvanize other people because of their own sort of FOMO as well. So look, just as we sort of wrap up, I want to talk again about Looking Glass and your thematic thesis, so health, climate, empowerment. So Nothing Ventured for me, you know, I launched this podcast a little bit because I wanted to explore the venture ecosystem, but also because you know, I think there are voices that we don't hear enough of from within the venture ecosystem. And I love the fact that you are focused on health, climate, and empowerment, because all of those three speak to me as frontier sort of areas where so much has to be done, and there are large swathes of the population that are underserved. So I'd love to understand from you about your thoughts about how you believe that those three, you know, those three themes are going to create positive impact, and why it was that you ultimately chose, you know, to focus on those areas. Because it's not as if you had a, you know, a background in health or a background in climate or anything per se. As we discussed, you know, the majority of your time has been spent within you know, various aspects of VC and certainly finance in general. So yeah, it'd be great to get you know, a bit of an understanding from you on all of that.
Sure. So when I was sitting down to think about what I wanted to spend time on with this firm, I knew I didn't want to be a generalist for a lot of reasons. I, as a single GP investing at the pre-seed stage, I think if you're a generalist, like, unless you're first round capital, right, you're not top of mind for anybody. And so I wanted to invest specifically in categories that I felt like I had a track record in. So when I looked at what I had invested in at DeepFork and Anchorage and as an angel, I could, you know, relatively easily bucket a significant percentage of my investments into these categories. I had made climate investments at DeepFork and Anchorage, like in companies like One Concern and Plant Prefab. I had made a number of healthcare and health related investments, including a company like Carrot in the smoking cessation space when I was at Anchorage. And this notion of empowerment, for me, I wanted to put a little bit more definition around what that means. And so I've called out a few categories: education, tools and platforms specifically serving small and medium-sized businesses, and then products that enable access, identity, or self-expression in some way. And so when I sort of took the totality of my investing career prior to starting Looking Glass, more than half of my investments at DeepFork, all of my investments at Anchorage, and all of my angel investments fell into these, you know, one of these three buckets. I also felt like these categories were very complementary. So to your point around empowerment and access, like, access oftentimes aligns with education. It oftentimes aligns with healthcare, particularly around, you know, underserved populations, you know, around mental health, women's health. Also oftentimes can align with, you know, with consumer finance and fintech, which can fall into this empowerment bucket, and even some small business sort of tools and marketplaces. And so for me, it was, while these are three sort of like distinct categories, I tag every deal that I look at, and a significant percentage of them have multiple tags because they align with one or two of these themes. And then, you know, sort of as an investor who is trying to tell a story to LPs, like, and also think about why these categories mattered, I felt like they attracted founders who were authentic and genuine. And I describe it as mission driven, and it's not necessarily social mission, though certainly to your point, a lot of these do have, you know, a social impact element to them, but it's far from a requirement. But they attract founders that are building companies for the right reason. If you're building a company in healthcare, climate, education, even some of the stuff around small business, like, these are very fraught areas, oftentimes like regulatorily complex, oftentimes like filled with you know, legacy players and incumbents who are disincentivized from adopting your software or any software at all. And so they're really not for the faint of heart, and they attract a founder that probably knows the space totally cold, or has like an obsessive reason for why they need, and deep, like deeply personal reason for why they want to solve a problem in these categories. And so I think they attract a naturally more resilient entrepreneur than some other categories do.
You can't be a tourist founder getting into like getting into climate or health, for sure.
Not really. I think it's, you would quite quickly realize or wonder why you quit your, you know, well-paying job at Facebook to go build something in climate when you weren't obsessed with like mitigating, you know, climate change. And then also, I think these categories are more recession resilient and economically resilient than a lot of others. So I mean, the New York Times actually put out an article a couple of days ago about climate tech being recession resilient. And they quoted Josh Felser, who's a VC that I got to know, who's started, left Freestyle and started Climactic. And they started, they quoted Rick Zullo, who's a sort of another GP emerging manager who runs Equal Ventures with Rich Kirby in New York, who I've been friends with for a long time. And they, you know, cite a bunch of their investments in the climate space that have been able to be successful despite sort of what the broader market looks like. And when you look at sort of the companies in my fund that have had the most fundraising success over the last 6 to 8 months, they've been healthcare companies, climate companies, and an education company. And so I think when companies are solving sort of a need, facilitating a need and not a want, they're solving like a must, you know, it's a must solve issue.
It's a painkiller versus vitamin, attract, right?
Yeah, pain, exactly. Pain, yeah. Painkiller over vitamin. Like, you're going to naturally attract capital and talent, frankly, as people are drawn to solving, you know, problems that they feel like really matter to them, when maybe there's other categories that just don't attract the same level of capital and talent during downturns.
Amazing. Adam, look, it's been incredible talking to you and understanding more about your background, about what you're doing at Looking Glass. For our listeners, if they're looking for you, where can they find you? Are you online? Are you on Twitter? Are you on LinkedIn? Where's the best place to come look for you?
I'm way too online. I'm way too much on Twitter. It's at Besvinick, BESVINICK on Twitter. And the Looking Glass website is lookingglass.vc.
Amazing. Adam, well, I hope you are wrapped up well against the cold, and thank you so much for joining me here today.
Awesome. Thanks, Arish. Really appreciate it.